Everybody behave naturally. So June will be coming along in just a moment. We're probably going to have to wrap up about 12:45. We've just got to take Linda to her next thing at 1:30. And so we would like to just kind of kick off. We've got like a set of questions we wanted to ask Linda, but I wanted to throw to the audience first. So would anybody, after listening to Linda's talk, have any questions? If you don't want to go first, I'm more than happy to go first. Go ahead.
Are you sure?
Okay. Thank you. She's been talking for a long time.
Well, the question has been crafted by the HD. Linda, my name is Liva Resende. I work here as a design historian, etc. But I'm also the coordinator of HDI studies. Mm-hmm. And we have a question that comes up very regularly. I mean, the great number of our HDIs are what we call practice-led research.
Yes.
Do practice-led research. Okay. But lately, because of some multiple and very interesting plural approaches to this idea of the creative reflective practitioner thing, other terminologies have started to crop up, such as practice-based research, mm-hmm. creative-led research, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So you've heard about these kind of recombinations.
Yes.
And we are intending to perhaps raise these conversations among the HDS advisors and so on, but what do you have in terms of how do you approach, do you think they are interchangeable, these terminologies, or do they mean different things?
Yes, well, as you can imagine, I've debated this with people, and certainly with my co-editors and authors, for this mammoth tome. And we decided in the end to use practice-based research as the all-embracing terminology. I had previously made a distinction between practice-led and practice-based because in my thinking at that time was that practice-led and practice-based had different approaches. So I showed you the artifact-led diagram there. There's also a problem-led practice-based research process. So the difference between the types of practice-based research really seem to come down to whether you are making something, you're actually creating a work of some kind, and it could be anything that goes across all disciplines, or you are researching through practice to change the nature of practice. Now, you may, in the end, come out with something like a new curriculum. Say it's to improve your teaching, which is the sort of thing that is very common. And in that sense, the practice-led research is in order to produce something that will be able to change or improve the nature of practice in whatever domain it is. And the artifact-led research, what we call practice-based in those days, in the early times of starting this, was really because the making process itself was what was informing the way that the person was thinking. And that was to do with the intimacy between maker and the object of making. Now, does that make sense? Yeah. As far as using the different terms, well, read the book. We've got lots of I could read you all the definitions. And I think we do need a safe way to describe this that is embracing a number of different approaches. Mm-hmm. At the same time, practice-based research has to have a clear, a clear sense of itself. What are you doing that is different from other forms of research? And that, I think, is the crucial thing. If it's practice-based or practice-led, creative-led, I'm not so sure about. Because it's all creative in that sense, in terms of generating new knowledge. But nevertheless, it has to have some consistency, and that's why this book was done, really, was to try to give the field of practice-based research a solid foundation. There are lots of people in academia who think very badly of practice-based research. Yeah? If you go into the straight scientific departments, they don't understand it. What on earth is this doing in academic research? This is not double-blind controlled experimentation. And it's all around the methodology. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a crucial thing. The methodology itself has to be made explicit. I think I was always struck by something that Professor Nigel Cross, who was he used to edit the Design Studies magazine, he would get many, many submissions that would say, I've created this lovely thing, and this is my research. And the problem was that it wasn't. It was a lovely piece of work, but there was no understanding. I mean, the artifact had to speak for itself, and it didn't. Not on paper, anyway. And I think that's the issue. What is the methodology that separates out the research understandings that come out from the research and the actual artifact itself? So, yes.
I just wanted to go on with Olivia's point. I've been using that distinction that you made for many years in a course that I teach for postgrads here, for practice-based postgrads here mainly. And they're always very confused about this. And the area that seems to bring up a lot of confusion is particularly with people who are doing creative research in technology-based areas. Mm-hmm. So this is where I'm really interested, mm-hmm. because, for example, if you're doing research into interactivity, for example, into some form of interactivity or human-machine interaction, and you are advancing some kind of knowledge about interactivity in that area, mm-hmm. you may also be making a work,
yes.
that in fact produces a number of different modes of interaction. So mm-hmm. this is where the postgrads get really confused.
Yes.
So I'm very grateful to hear that you're not too worried about that distinction anymore.
No.
And I'm wondering, because I'm actually teaching this class this afternoon.
Okay.
Exactly on this issue. And I'm wondering whether I should take that slide out or not, or leave it there and get them to reflect on it themselves.
Yes. Very, very interesting, actually, because one of the things that I discovered when I first worked in a computer science department, many of the PhDs were submissions of new software.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
This was, ancient history again, but nevertheless, the new software was often presented as that's the new knowledge, okay, and it's embodied in that software. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to convince people that they needed to go a step further. Okay, have you evaluated that software? Have you done some performance tests? Is it usable?
Mm-hmm.
What is new about it? And it isn't the piece of software itself might run beautifully, but does it tell you all those things about whether it's more usable, whether it's advancing some programmable concept in some way? So I think the same thing applies now.
Yeah.
Is the work itself, is the technology different? Is it new? And if it is, in what way? And what's people often don't realise that they are reinventing the wheel very often. They haven't done their state-of-the-art study, and they haven't really considered, what has happened before that already does this? And that's just no...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm afraid I'm a bit old school here. Scholarship requires it, even in practice-based research, especially in practice-based research. So if you're doing whatever technological artifacts you're concerned with, you need to know what it is that other people have done. And your methodology can be a PhD outcome. There's no question about that. But you have to demonstrate it. And, I mean, I do say that I hear that from artists, and a particular friend of mine who used to say, the painting speaks for itself, I don't have to explain it. And I knew what he meant, but the painting only spoke to those who understood his language. And that's the problem. Is there a common language that is shareable with the rest of the world? And that common language, whatever it may be, in mathematics, when you do a mathematics PhD, the language is understood, the notations are understood amongst the expert mathematicians. but it has to be clear to them that you've made some advance. Now, it's the same applies elsewhere. If you produce something which you say is an advance on whatever was preceded it, you need to be able to show why that is the case, how that is the case.
But does that delegitimize anything that that occurs outside of academia? I mean, it delegitimizes everything from the Gent to, or I mean, whatever period. I mean, because that wasn't the framework.
No, well, it doesn't delegitimize it at all, because you're not doing PhDs in the real world. PhDs are a particular thing that conform to academic rules, and you can argue about those rules, but it doesn't delegitimize anything that goes out there. Now, I've come across young artists, I nevertheless would say this, that I've come across young artists who've shown me, I remember someone showing me something that was very much like Sid Fels's work, Iamoscope, which was a beautiful interactive thing. And she had not been aware of his work at all. She wasn't a researcher, she hadn't found that out. And she was very excited about what she'd done, which everybody who looked at it thought, ah, yes, that's been done before. That doesn't mean to say that her methods might not have been innovative, and it was new to her. And it was important that it was new to her, and it might have been new to people in her community. So no, it doesn't delegitimize it at all, but it does mean that when it comes to an academic context, you need to be clear that you're following academic conditions.
PhD versus PhD, go.
So does that necessitate then participant studies? What are your views on participant studies? You make a piece of artwork.
Yes.
And then it is evidently necessary for you to do a participant study to validate your PhD.
No.
Where were you 2 years ago?
But you need to be conscious of the method that you use to reflect on what you've done.
The progress, right.
Yes. So people need to be able to, and in fact I think this is why diagrams are very helpful, they need to be able to explain their process. Mm-hmm. To understand where their decision points were, which directions they went in, when they had to change direction and why, what their stumbling blocks were. Rather, you would do this in a big engineering project. People do this all the time. It's like a research project in many ways. And then you articulate it in words. And I think, of course, the audience studies are very nice and very helpful to do, and people do them in their own reflective practice, their own critical, self-critical work, side by side with some audience studies as well. I mean, that's fine, but it's not essential.
I'm going to quote you on that.
Oh dear.
Also, if you're going to ask something very similar to that, and then going on also about what Anna said, I face a similar conundrum. I feel working on in technology, especially working with artificial intelligence, and what you were referencing as artificial intelligence as a creative partner, which is basically human computer interaction. And essentially what I'm doing is trying to find effective ways in which humans and AI can collaborate, which involves definitely participant studies, and you want to validate the software that you use to see if it's actually effective. But the process to get there to that software, it's this long process where I suspect there's a lot to reflect on. And I'm not exactly sure how to integrate it in my research, because I feel that if I don't integrate it, I would be wasting a lot of hours that I'm actually, as a practitioner, building the software. You know, and you get to the user studies, and I feel that's the tip of the iceberg, but below that there's a lot of reflection that can be done. So the way that I'm approaching it now is sort of kind of combining those two approaches, so reflecting on the process and then doing participant studies. So is that something that would make sense, do you think, that would make the most important?
Yes, I think it would, but I also would add that when you reflect on the process, you need to document. And I mean, in the old days, we used to document our programs, but I think that wasn't good enough for you. You have to be able to say, I flashed up a slide there about documenting. Ask the kind of questions you need to ask yourself. because I think what is interesting here is to focus on your process and how you as a reflective practitioner are able to reveal what it is that you've done, which not only illuminates how the technology works, but illuminates how the work that you've done works. And I think those two in parallel make a very good combination. Then you can do your user audience, whatever studies. Once you've kind of understood what it is that really matters, and you may well, while you're doing all this, you may well be changing your mind about things a lot. And changing your mind is quite an interesting thing to record, to document, because then you can give a design rationale for that, because it might inform how you shift the design of the system that you're working on. And I should say that I'm very pleased to hear that you're doing work in a kind of HCI AI combination. Great.
Yeah.
And do you know about Ben Schneiderman's initiative on this?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you, have you joined his? He does a fantastic newsletter about the initiatives going on in HCI and AI, and documents it beautifully. And he's just brought out a new book on the subject, because he's trying to influence the world about human uses of AI, which is well needed. And also, it's you can put in what he's doing as far as this community he's built, you can actually send him examples of what you're doing. And I mean, he'll be thrilled to know somebody else is, someone's doing a PhD in this area.
Yeah, we're getting that with Ollie.
Yeah. So do you know Ben's?
I didn't know about the news.
Oh, okay. Well, I can send you. You can join it, and then you get regular things from him, which are all very helpful. Really interesting stuff.
I also have his ABCs of Research. If you want to borrow it.
Sorry.
The ABCs of Research.
Yeah.
If you want to borrow it, that's a slightly older book.
That's an older book. The one he's just brought out is specifically addressing HCI issues in AI, and there's all sorts of things to do with ethics and. How do we shift the design process to incorporate, which is something that's an old thing, to incorporate the human in this model. And I think that's well overdue. This whole notion of superseding the human is obviously something that has, well, it's had millions, billions spent on it. And now there is a shift in people's perception, which Ben is trying to promote. And although he's supposedly retired, he's like another one of these people that can never leave it go. And he's working very hard to make sure people understand the issues.
And from your perspective, working in technology, do you feel there's one particular type of documentation that works best? Because I feel sometimes documenting gets in the way of the flow of coding, and you know, you get so deep in your coding, and then you kind of like take a break to document, and you kind of like lose that flow.
Mm.
So I'm trying to like take screenshots, take, you know, video recordings of my screen, but then they get like 2 hours long and then I never go back to them. But maybe
is there
like
a good way?
Black notes on the side. Yeah.
Well, you have to find your own way, of course. But, well, I think it's hard to break the flow once you're inside something, because you're trying to keep so many things in play at the same time. So I would take review points. I would build review points into the process. I would start with some handwritten documents or typed up documentation about, okay, I'm about to start this, and my intentions are now to do this. I'm going to use this method. I'm going to try this. I'm experimenting with this, blah, 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 blah. And then give yourself however long you feel you're most productive on your programming, and then stop and say, okay, look back at what you've written at the beginning and say, okay, what's changed in that process? Have I done what I said I would do? Have I changed something? So get those review points built in. It may be after a half an hour, it may be after an hour. Don't leave it too long.
Thanks so much.
Lisa had a question.
Thank you. I'm starting my master's, so I was just wondering what your thoughts are on when you're beginning this process, where to actually commence. So that was really helpful, your answer there. Is there anything else that you would recommend as a starting point? In addition to becoming really practiced at logging your workflow, is there anything else you would suggest?
Well, it does depend a lot on what your aims are.
Yes.
And are you making stuff?
I'm making a virtual reality artwork.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. So that's important. I think you need to certainly write down what your initial objectives are.
Mm-hmm.
And try to write as much as you can of the, you know, what's my vision for this? What's my, what, and if you can think of the intention, what would you like it to be like? What would you like the experience to be like? And write it down at the beginning. And then always have these different points that I've said about the review points. I think that can help. And wherever you get some influence from somewhere, you've seen something that's appealing, you've read something, document that too. What have been the influences that have perhaps shifted my thinking as I'm developing big work? And I mean, there is a thing about what questions you should be asking yourself in chapter 7 in this book.
Okay, right. I'll be reading that. Thank you.
This book's in the library too.
Excellent. Thank you.
It looks very well used.
Oh, yes. Yes, you can thank Naomi for that. She's like, yes. Smashed a water bottle across the bottom of it. Any other questions?
I've got one just around these kind of, you talk about academic conditions and academic form. I'm thinking like, well, how do we also reflect on how that is impacting the form of our research?
Mm-hmm.
Especially obviously when you're in an institution, and obviously there's lots of pressures within that, and milestones. And,
mm-hmm.
Have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I think a lot depends on the rules that have been laid down, and they may be old. The rules that have been laid down for submissions for projects and PhD outcomes. That's an important starting point. So does the organisation, does UNSW have words which are conducive to practice-based research, as in does it have specific acknowledgement of so-called non-traditional outcomes? Is that so?
It does. It's actually pretty...
Yeah.
Good at it,
yes. And which, and a question to ask is, which committee came up with that?
Sure.
And has it been revised lately?
It's basically this school has done everything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
We exported to other schools and faculties.
Okay.
Yeah.
And look for what other people are doing too in other universities.
Yeah.
I always quote De Montfort because Craig Veer, who was the editor in this book, and Ernest Edmonds, who were both professors there at one time. Craig has just moved on to Nottingham now, but they actually wrote the rules and put them forward to the research committee and said, this is what we need to have in here for our research, the side of research that we're doing in their creative technologies unit. And the other people to try to make sure are on board are the whatever research arm you've got,
yeah,
who support the project development stuff. I mean, a lot of them maybe not be in direct, I don't know, I'm talking only about my own experience. Some people are directly involved in the academic work as well, but some people are not, and they come into research management without some experience of what it is, what is the mission that is going on here. What is it about? The educative side doesn't always get prominent. So if you've got the capacity to go in and influence that, then do it. And certainly the best way to propagate ideas is to make it happen in the first place. And don't expect to get any bouquets for doing that.
Yeah.
People in academia, I've found, don't respond very well to change. That's really weird, isn't it, when you think about it? I mean, the people on the front are very often the teaching staff are just struggling to carry the workload out. The researchers who've got more time can give some real thought to what are universities for, and that sometimes gets lost. So if you can influence in whatever way you can for people to actually talk to those at the front edge of doing this work. And I actually think it's very important to bring practitioners who are not academics into your work.
Yeah.
And get them to talk about what they do, get them to meet the students and to, you know, and become students, although that can have a negative effect on them too. So I don't know if that helps at all, but
thank you very much.
Are there any other questions?
I just a comment, if I may, because Nalvinda, I think with being part of the HDR, you know, part of things here, I have always been very pleasantly surprised as institutions go how we can really not just accommodate, but we are playing here with the idea we export, you know, some of these ideas of practice-based research and whatever. I think we're all very confident, and we all come from practice in a way, so we have that lived experience of being doing practice-based research and so on. But following up from Sky's question, I think there is also the agency of the students, as you suggested, in affecting change and being at the forefront. And one of the key things that has happened, especially post-pandemic, has been how students have been collaborating, how it's sort of, there's a lot of cross-collaboration in things like crits, which are amazing points of review. If you're critting for someone else, it's not for your review panel, it's not about milestones, it's not about the institution, it's about you guys getting together and doing your crits on the fourth floor, here, block A, wherever you want to go, and having those points of review, and being able to be very tacit, very kind of candid about the processes as well. And this is absolutely essential. Communities of practice are as essential as the institution kind of frameworks that we are going to be put in favor or not, that, you know, going to preclude your progress. So I think that's one thing the institution can offer you: space, time, scholarship, and support, and kind of a community of practice to actually get these things going. When you come, you're the next generation of us, right? And you come and you're going to be doing things differently, but that's going to be incredibly well informed for everything you're building up from here. So yeah, that, you know, don't forget you've got a lot of anti-institutional or cross-institutional agency here too.
It's actually one of the first things I learned from Ernest and Linda working at Creativity and Cognition Studios, is that community is definitely important.
Yes.
So that's the first artist studio in a way that I worked in, was Ernest and Linda's studio. And I had never worked in an artist studio before. I'd only been to a few museums. I had two art history degrees and just had never really gone or been involved in that side of things, in the making side. And when I saw the way that everyone came together once a week and talked about their projects and talked about, you know, sitting around like a table like this and just going through everything that you were doing, something like twigged in my mind. And I've kind of followed that process for the last 15 years after that, because it was so effective. Mm-hmm. Still is effective at CCS.
Yes, I think so. And I think doing a master's or a PhD can be a very lonely business.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sense that you have of other people by your side, maybe doing something quite different, but nevertheless that are struggling with the same issues, is very important. And it's not, I mean, the old traditional thing of doing a PhD, for example, you found your guru, your supervisor or your advisor, and you sort of beg to see that person, and if you were lucky, you got to see them once a year. But now, of course, you can learn so much more by having, as has been described, the community and people sharing the struggles that they're having, sharing their ideas in a way that is not just academically supportive, it's personally supportive. And I think that's essential. Think of the, or the rounded way that looking after students and people who are, it applies to staff too, because there are, I don't know how it works here, but staff themselves who are perhaps trying to do a higher degree, have it before you start at UNSW, but in some places you don't. There are staff who are actually doing this alongside their teaching as well.
Yeah.
And that's it's quite interesting that once you become the student rather than the teacher, it's a very different experience. The fear factor comes into play. You're not the authority.
Hannah, you had another comment?
I just had a comment, which was, I was very grateful that you put on one of the slides some statements by artists about their moments of reflection. And you pointed to, I think it was Esther's one, about the drawing spoke to me, or the drawing taught me.
Yes.
And I also just wanted to point out to students in the room that when you're documenting your process, those little moments come out, and it's those moments that you then pull out of the documentation that become the moments where the reflection really happened. And that's why it's so important to have all those. And you see, artists are quite happy to share those sorts of things, but students are constantly worried that that's trivial, or that's not something that examiners would be interested in, or that, you know, that's just something I thought about. And I was very happy that you put that up there, just to reinforce how important it is that you guys all do that as well, and have that bank of material to pull out and put in your documentation, put in your dissertation, and make sure the examiners see it. Because I've examined over 30 PhDs, and every time I see that stuff in a PhD, I love it.
Like, you can combine that, yes.
Oh, my God, that's where it is.
I absolutely agree, and you can combine that with all the analytical work you might do. I mean, it's not a problem. And interesting, you mentioned Esther Rollinson. She's the one who did the splinter work. She hasn't done a PhD, but she works as if she is a researcher.
Yes.
That is absolutely fundamental to what she does. And why is that the case? Well, she's forever pushing the boundaries of what she can do, so she has to be always alert to things that are outside her domain. She just recently did a lighting work in Cleethorpes, which is a little tiny seaside town in England. And it involved a whole team of engineers who she had to manage, negotiate. And the engineers had different views about how much load bearing these things could have. And she had to hold her ground and say, well, you say I can only have one string of LEDs, well, it requires two. So find me the supports that you need to do that. And she was, and they did. These engineers went off and thought, well, okay, we've got a challenge here. And I think her whole notion about the research and how it informs her practice is coupled with that artist's determination to do what it is that she wants to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important recognition, that's that you don't bow to things just because some engineer says you can't do it. It's very interesting to see how different people react. Most of the engineers want to do it. They like a challenge too.
Yeah.
She just happened to meet the wrong one first and then had to find another one.
Step aside.
Yes. Yes.
Are there any other questions or comments, Ollie?
I just wanted to kind of pick up a little bit on that theme, on something that I think is so kind of going back to that Emma's point about just the power of those quotes. And in the design world, which you also know really well, we see this, that like in certain areas like Kai, we see this sort of real insistence on there being user studies. And
yes,
those can be really powerful, but they can also be a huge waste of time and resources if you haven't done the creative reflective practice on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the flip side, what you're saying about computer scientists submitting a piece of software and saying, there you go. The flip side is someone doing a study on a piece of software that's really not well enough developed.
Yes.
And the correct, efficient use of your time and resources and the government's resources that's paying for this research to be done is not to do a really elaborate user study, but to just do an incredibly efficient.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think that under one of the HCI programs, we worked on developing usability guidelines for this kind of thing. One of the essentials with software is to ensure that the performance level of the software is adequate before you take it on to the next stage, which is to say, well, whatever its function is, whatever its purpose is, does it work effectively? In other words, does it meet the user or the team's requirements? But if you can't even make it run properly and it just falls down every time somebody gives it blows at it, then there's no point. And one of the things that we did was to have this hierarchy of things. Performance level, you would have metrics for that kind of thing. Then you would have, what's the task effectiveness of this work? How efficient is the system? And the last thing on the list was user satisfaction, because all of those other things had to work first. Now, in art, I think it's a bit different, because if the artist is actually not quite sure how the audience is going to interact with it and wants to put a prototype in there that's not quite as robust as it might be, it still has to be sufficiently robust. That was one of the requirements that we had at Beta Space, which at the Powerhouse, was that
you couldn't put things into the public domain without the software and the system being robust enough to stand public use.
Or the materials.
Or the materials, yes. And of course, there's safety factors involved in that too. But once you get through that process, then you can, once you've got the software that you think you want, and this is the art, I'm talking about artists here, when they're doing something, they've got their installation, it's interactive or it's not. How the audience reacts to it is, it can confirm what you've already assumed, or it can make you very disappointed. But it's one of those reflection at a distance things that I mentioned. You then it's at a distance, that when you put it out to the audience, it's away from you. You've done something else there. You've taken it in to the minds of other people and the experiences of other people. And suddenly, it doesn't quite belong to you in the same way. And I think that's very revealing, and that's very helpful. Can be terrifying too, of course. But it's a worth doing. As far as the Kai type, this is the sort of HCI community, they've been doing silly little, I say, they've been doing these small tests on, you know, tiny little usability tests. I remember going to a conference in Atlanta, I think it was, where someone did a test on what was the right kind of measure that you could have for software for old people. These were people from Norway, I think, or somewhere. I think they did actually use that term, older people. And quite a few people in the audience were quite, because the people doing the presentation were quite young, and quite a few people in the audience weren't that young and were going up and offering themselves as subjects. And what they'd done was really very limited. And it's these small things. And I know that people would argue that back in the early days, you had to do that. You had to make these interfaces more effective. I wish people who did design websites had read some of Don Norman's and Jacob Nielsen's guidelines, because some of them are absolutely appalling. But all of those things, really, they don't add up to anything significant if the software itself, or if the system, think of it as a system really, isn't able to be exploited to its full potential.
I just had a small one. It's backing up from the reflective practice stuff a little bit and more in the sort of space of the sort of digital creativity sort of overlap you're talking about there. You discussed this sort of division or whatever, or like the model of like supersizing, not superseding. I'd be interested in hearing your perspective on that, especially in the last like 18 months and things like that, with all the like new AI art tools and things like that, like Midjourney and Stable Diffusion. Like, there's a pretty explicit attempt, it seems, in some of that around superseding.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just, yeah, I'm not sure.
Yes, well, I mean, the superseding idea has been around a long time. And it all started initially with this idea that you could model computationally human creative work. And the people who were doing the modelling in the early days had no idea what art or music or anything like that was. But they thought that they could produce an image or produce some sounds that would be sufficient evidence of creative, the ability to produce some sort of creative work, and therefore we wouldn't need humans anymore. In fact, I know my friend Paul Brown, who I showed up there, actually said to me once, well, you know, soon robots will be able to do it all for us and we can just not bother. And it struck me that, well, I can see why you'd want a robot and an AI system to do safety critical work, if you could get one that you could really rely on. And that's a big issue. But why would you want to take away the innovation and the opportunity for change that comes from interacting with something that can generate more? Because whatever you would say about these AI systems, they rely upon data from things that humans have already done, and they, at least as far as I understand, in terms of the image generation stuff. A lot of graphic designers are very unhappy about that, because now these images can be created without any reference to their work, and they may be out of work because somebody else has thought it perfectly okay to borrow their images. And I think there are lots of, I think I mentioned the ethical questions, I think there's lots of ethical questions here. So superseding works where it really matters, but supersizing is the only way we can actually get the most out of human potential. And I think that's the point, isn't it, really? Do we want to just have, you know, Brave New World, all the epsilons are all just chuntering along watching, I don't know, what do people watch nowadays? Marriage at First Sight or something, I don't know. I had to watch that because one of my grandchildren told me that it was a must, and it was the Marriage at First Sight Australia.
Oh dear.
It opened my eyes to a whole new world.
He can't unlearn it.
Yes. So I think if I'm with the Ben Schneiderman initiative, we need to harness the power of this AI potential. And we need to know more about it. People, the journalists who write about it really have, they've got things to answer for. They should learn more, and they should talk to people who actually know what they're talking about, instead of always picking out a few people who are sort of what I call the academic gurus, who are, you know, forever spouting about the power of superseding AI without talking about all the other things. Yes, the snake oil salesman. So I don't know if that gives you a picture of where I am on this. I mean,
So it's about 1:45 now, and probably everyone's shifting around, getting hungry for lunch. But is there any one or two last minute questions or comments for Linda?
I'm very happy to answer any questions by email if you want to follow up. Don't hesitate. I have to check my spam folder all the time now because for some reason it has decided that everybody who emails me is shouldn't.
Well, thanks very much, Linda.